Welcome to Augmented Humanity. Our guests are modern explorers working at the intersection of technology and the humanities. They help us to understand ourselves and the worlds we create in this digital age. They are thinkers, creators, makers, and academics working in diverse fields like history, the visual arts, communications, and comparative religion. I'm your host, Craig Goldsmith.
I'm your host, Ellen Dornan.
We're joined today by Dr. Catherine Knight Steele, an assistant professor of communication at the University of Maryland, College Park. Dr. Steele was the founding director of the African American Digital Humanities Initiative and currently directs the Black Communication and Technology Lab as a part of the Digital Inquiry, Speculation, Collaboration, and Optimism Network.
Thank you so much for talking with us today. I did want to talk a little bit about your book, which is out in October, right?
Yes.
Digital Black Feminism. And I figured out partway through the book that it was Black Feminism in a Digital Space. I just went to a responsible tech conference last week, and I have been thinking, what would better digital spaces look like? What contributes to a better digital space? And you come up with a lot of principles and practices of Black feminism that are expressed in digital spaces in all kinds of ways. And so I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about some of those and about what it might mean for other digital spaces.
I think that the biggest takeaway in doing the book and thinking for a lot of months and years about the topic is that what makes for a better digital space is what would make for a better space offline too. The same things that we're fighting in digital realms, the same kinds of oppressive forces that find their way into the Twitterverse, the same kinds of violence that Black women deal with online, they deal with offline. The same kinds of ways that we're separated, we are separated offline. And until we're really ready to tackle some of the issues that are weaving their way and have woven their way into the fabric of our society more broadly, we can't do it in a digital way, right? We can't make these fixes to pieces of our society in hopes that they will undo the problems that are really at the root and the core. And I think a lot of the technology fixes that we're looking for in terms of, well, maybe we can turn off the comment sections, or maybe we can have more moderation, or we can do these other things. We're really trying to put a Band-Aid on what's a big old bullet hole, right? But I think what I try to do in the book is talk about how Black women have navigated these spaces in ways that have helped them survive and thrive in the face of seeming as though they shouldn't, right? So some of those principles that I outline are less directives from me and more observations from what women have done in particularly spaces like the blogosphere, which I think is really important that we still talk about because it was this really unique moment where Black women operated their own spaces online, where they were very much not reliant on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or TikTok to have control over what could be posted or how long it could be or what it could look like or who could participate. And that is really a moment where we get to see people have the space to come up with some interesting principles and some interesting praxis. So that's where I think we should turn our attention to is when did people have the opportunity to do all of that? And what did they do when they did?
You look at this as a case where it was successful.
Yeah, I think success in so much as that's where it was built. I think that's what I would say. I think digital Black feminism was built in the blogosphere, and we've seen its outputs happen. Now we don't see the blogosphere as much, right? So everywhere else, we're kind of seeing these principles play out in other places. And I think there's some testing of them that's happening right now as to whether or not they hold up for folks who are interested in doing Black feminist liberatory work.
You talked about putting the Band-Aid on the bullet hole. Are you saying that what might be systemic or systemic violence towards Black women, you just basically see those same sort of behaviors play out online?
Unfortunately, I think it's all part of the same kind of mess that we've created for ourselves as a country, right? I do believe in harm reduction, right? And I think it's important that we do as often as possible talk about the very real ways that institutions and companies and organizations and governments have responsibilities toward harm reduction. we can do a both and, right? Of that, like, you know, it
Yeah.
doesn't mean we throw up our hands and say whatever happens online is just what's happening. We can't address any problem until we get to the core. We can do both. We can do the walking and the chewing, and we can make sure that these companies are accountable to the people who are making them billions of dollars, because in many ways, Black women are making them billions of dollars by being tastemakers and trendsetters and influencers and early adopters of these technologies. And so if we are the ones that are making them the money, they have a responsibility.
I hadn't even thought about that. And that's clear if you look at who the influencers are.
Absolutely.
You had talked about violence online. Some people would think it was reasonable to say, well, sticks and stones may break your bones, and it's just online, and you're just getting trolled. And it's not the same as someone throwing a rock through your front window, but you're suggesting it's violence. And so what does that look like?
I am. And I think that there's a point in my life where I would have said something similar. And I think until one experiences the kind of persistent harassment and diminishment and doxing and all of these things that happen, and the way that they're so targeted, everyone doesn't get that online. And I think it's really important to say that, because I know that that argument happens often. It's like, well, you know, everybody's kind of mean to people online. Everybody has had to deal with, you know, somebody's gotten a bad comment on their post. Yeah, we've all gotten someone who said something offhandedly bad. Have we all gotten sustained weeks of harassment? You know, have we all gotten pictures of our loved ones posted without our consent and commentary about our family members? Have we all gotten violent threats of sexual assault in our private messages or sent to our employer? I don't think we've all gotten that. I'm clear that we haven't, because I know that if everyone were getting it, we would see it as a bigger problem. But because the people who most often get that are women, and on top of that are women of color, we have not decided that it's as big of a problem as it actually is. From the Black women that I study, what a lot of them have decided to do is leave those spaces, spaces that at one time were not only vibrant communal spaces for cultural production, but were also financially viable spaces for them to make money. I think what we're finding is that in some ways, the blogosphere was this beautiful moment. The early Twitter days were these nice places. And we've reached a point now where some folks have decided this isn't working out anymore, because the protections that we had in those spaces just don't exist anymore over here. And the allowance that we've made as a society for this vile behavior over time has encouraged it to amplify.
And that kind of speaks to what you were saying, that it's no different than what's happening necessarily in meat space, which is if you don't feel comfortable going into the store or eating at the restaurant because someone's just going to be so ridiculously unpleasant, and now you've actually cut yourself off from what might have been a very important part of your personal and professional life.
What I'll say is the added piece to that, though, is what if the restaurant needed mean people in order to survive? I want to go to the museum, but in order to go to the museum, I have to be subjected to harassment because the museum needs harassers. They require it for their platform survival.
You talk about a few cases where creators were able to move from an enclave or from a space where they had a lot of control over who could respond or who was part of the conversation to bigger platforms or owned platforms. And it sounds like sometimes it works out, and sometimes people sort of split their effort across platforms instead of just being present in one space, where they can be a little bit more personal in spaces that feel slightly safer. It's interesting to me how you describe the losses and wins.
Yeah, definitely. So I'll just give a couple examples, right? So we had folks who started in the blogosphere, really small blogs, their friends from college reading them, that grew into these couple thousand people a day reading. It was pretty big, you know, at the time, and grew to a point where they started to get some media attention, some book deals, people recognizing the talent and the skill that was necessary to cultivate those spaces. Some of my favorite writers started out that way and have now been New York Times bestselling authors and, you know, have their own platforms. But you're absolutely right. There is a give and take to it. And it's an individual decision as to what is most useful at that moment for the individual. And I think that that's part of what digital Black feminism allows for in really interesting ways that pushes a little bit off from the original conceptions of Black feminist thought of the 60s and 70s, that you have digital Black feminists who are making decisions decisions that are very much about their own agency and their own financial success unapologetically, that they are suggesting that while my community really matters and my ability to make a difference there, I don't have to sacrifice my own personal success in order to do that. I don't have to say no to everything. I don't have to keep everything hidden in order to do that. I demand the space to take up space in these other realms where you suggest I shouldn't be. And it's a fascinating thing to watch happen because I think there is some tension between other feminist thinkers who are saying, watch out for what happens when you get these platforms. Are you going to still be able to be voiced to those who need someone to speak on their behalf? Are you going to be able to still raise the same kinds of issues and tell the same kinds of stories? One of my favorite pair of writers are Damon Young and Panama Jackson, who started a blog called Very Smart Brothers back in 2007. And these are some of the few men I write about in the book because they're just some of my favorite men. And they've had immense success with this blog and also separately from the blog in writing their own books and developing other things for the internet and writing in major newspapers and major magazines and things like that. But the community that they created in that blog, now everyone has access to. And the kind of enclave discourse that provided a sense of protection of some of the topics that were covered there isn't exactly the same anymore, for good and bad. It's great that everyone has access to some of these topics. People need to be reading these men's work. They are fantastic, brilliant writers. But that also brings in the trolls, and it brings in the people who live to make discussions like this go away. I don't think any of these folks were unprepared for this consequence of their action, because the same thing happens at work and the same thing happens in your neighborhood when you move, right? And so there is always this knowledge of what happens when you take something that is a private community discussion and make it public.
When you open those doors, you're making a decision of sorts, even if some of your goal may be to familiarize people with what you have going on. I personally am always a believer in that. If I become something familiar to you and not strange, I think that builds bridges, but it also means you're opening yourself up to whoever wants to walk in the door.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think a lot of the Black women that I write about on Twitter have found that to be the case, that the familiarity that was an integral part of building a following, of getting people to listen, has now turned into demands from people who think they know you and you should write about this topic I tell you to write about and I should have some say so over your life. And we see a lot of that response happening now with Black women who will casual tweet about what they're doing. You shouldn't do that. You should be writing about, why aren't you doing more of this? That's actually not appropriate. You really don't know these people. And so that familiarity coupled with the misogynoir, to use Moya Bailey's phrase.
Wait, what's that term again?
Misogynoir. And so Moya Bailey gives us this word, which is a really brilliant word to talk about misogyny as specifically directed toward Black women, that there's a very specific form of misogyny that Black women experience. And misogynoir coupled with this personal relatable quality that was necessary in a lot of the branding leads to this demand that your body is one that I see as laborer, right? You are here to do a service for me, write for me, dance for me, do whatever it is that I need you to do in this moment. And I think we've seen that play out online. We've seen that play out during election cycles. There's countless spaces where we ask Black women to do the labor of fixing, of making things better, of alleviating the stress of the environment or of rectifying some wrong that they didn't create.
As I was reading your book, I was watching this happen in real time. So a while back, we talked to some medievalists who are really active on Twitter. One of the leading scholars in the field is a Black woman, and all the medievalists say there's no Atlantis, and all the trolls pile on the Black woman for it.
Right. Saying the same thing. There are certain people, certain humans, certain images that we're more comfortable with as our villain. And there are folks that we're more comfortable with as our heroes. And there are folks that we see as victims and folks that we see as they had it coming. And these are really long-term systems that are really hard to undo when we're not willing to acknowledge that they exist.
that's where I felt like where you sort of revealed spaces where these things are not existing in this way or not as toxic, where there's different kinds of ways of knowing or different kinds of discourse or more mutuality or prioritizing self-care, things like that.
Right. And some of these things have worked their way into the mainstream and in productive ways. And some of them have worked their way into the mainstream in ways that are less productive. The version of self-care that I talk about in the book comes to us from Audre Lorde, who's talking about the preservation of the self as a Black woman as an act of political revolution. Audre Lorde wasn't talking about bath bombs and, you know, scented candles and whether we made it to yoga this week. But of course, that's what we were thinking. And that's actually really a brilliant rhetorical strategy used by folks to undermine revolutionary thought. We do this with so many terms, right? And so another thing that's come out of Black feminist studies that this has happened with is the term intersectionality, unfortunately, which is a really powerful and important concept that has come to mean a lot of things that are not what the person who coined that term meant, Kimberly Crenshaw, nor the countless other Black women who have been writing about this notion of intersectionality in different ways for a lot of years.
Dr. Steele, the time just flies.
It flies.
We can't thank you enough for your time and enthusiasm and humor today.
Great to be here.
For more information about Dr. Steele and her book, Digital Black Feminism, you can visit KatherineKnightSteele.com. That's Catherine with a C, Knight with a K-N, and STEELE.com. Augmented Humanity is a program of the New Mexico Humanities Council produced in partnership with KUNM-FM. You can visit us online and find out more about our programs at nmhumanities.org. Our theme music comes courtesy James Whiten, and we've had production assistance from Tristan Klum.
So you can find me just sitting at my crossroads waiting for the light to change, and the same familiar faces come up.